part by a grant from Birkenstock Concepts by Heel to Toe in downtown Urbana. For over 25 years, offering all sizes and widths of Birkenstocks, from clogs and sandals to work, dress, and sport shoes. Birkenstock Concepts offers repair and modification services and a certified podorthist and orthotist on staff.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. Journalist Richard Cohen was stricken with multiple sclerosis 30 years ago. He was a young television producer, 25 years old. He's battled the disease for those 30 years. Despite losing his vision and two bouts of colon cancer, he's winning the fight. He says, "The upside of my life more than compensates for the downside." Susie Becker was a successful young entrepreneur, writer, and artist who for years suffered seizures in the middle of the night. Finally, she went to the doctor. Surgery was in order, and a mass was removed from her head. The aftermath of the surgery was frightening. Shown a picture of a key, she couldn't remember what to call it. But like Cohen, Becker is a fighter and a survivor. Susie Becker and Richard Cohen are our guests this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. We'll talk with them about coping with serious illness. Both have written memoirs about their experiences. Richard Cohen is the author of Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness. Susie Becker is the author of I Had Brain Surgery, What's Your Excuse? Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. I welcome your phone calls. Here are the numbers. In the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside the local dialing area, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Richard, Susie, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
Susie, you attributed your seizures to stress before you knew what was really going on. How long had you been living with those seizures?
About 5 years. And, the first one I kind of got myself through, and it was like a near-death experience. And I really, once I survived it, I just wanted to put it behind me. After the second one, I actually went to a doctor, and she diagnosed it as a stress episode, which she thought was my body's reaction to kind of everything that was going on in my life at the time. And as someone who had walked around with an irrational fear of brain surgery, a stress episode was a preferable diagnosis to the alternative. So I was kind of happily living with it for a while until someone was with me when I had one and made me go get a second opinion.
Yeah, and then what was the word then?
Well, then that initiated a round of tests and things to rule out the possibility that it might possibly be a mass in my head. And, of course, there was a mass in my head and that it needed to be surgically removed. Had the surgery, which they thought would present a risk to my right-side mobility. And as an artist, that was kind of a scary proposition. But it unexpectedly affected my language, my reading, writing, sense of humor, and all of that, which ended up being, a really scary reality.
Yeah. Richard, when and how were you diagnosed?
Well, I was 25 years old, and on a single day had a series of mishaps that were strange to me because they seemed out of character. They involved dropping a coffee pot, falling off a curb, and discovering numbness in a leg, and those all combined. And by the way, in those days, a diagnosis of MS was really a protracted, very inconclusive process. It could take months, if not years, to diagnose. But ironically, my father, who's now 86, then a practicing physician, diagnosed it on the phone immediately, and I thought he was jumping to conclusions, to say the least, but he was correct.
Yeah, and how was it, do you think, he nailed it so quickly?
Well, I just think he'd seen enough of it and drew on his own experiences and just spotted it.
Yeah. And he also suffers with MS, yes?
Correct.
Right. Okay. We already have a listener who's waiting for us on the phone, someone who must be listening this afternoon on the internet in San Francisco. So let's go and talk with this caller. Good afternoon. Line four, go ahead. Okay, they must have dropped off. They're welcome to give us a call back at 800-222-9455. A couple of the things that I want to talk with both of you about this afternoon, denial and coping. These are two words that we use a lot, that get thrown around a lot, but I think most of us, I don't think we really know. I don't think we really understand. And denial, I think, interestingly enough, has helped both of you along the way. It can help us keep going. Richard, maybe you would talk with us about how it played a role in your ability to continue working as a journalist.
Well, I denied the diagnosis immediately. I had just finished producing a documentary with McNeil and Lehrer on disability and felt that I had such a strong identification with a lot of the people, contemporaries of mine, who I had dealt with, that I was convinced that I was just identifying with them. But when I went blind in one eye three or four months later, that being a classic manifestation of the illness, really I couldn't deny the diagnosis anymore. But I think that for me the key was denying the inevitability of possible outcomes. I just denied that the worst case scenario, or even anything close to it, was going to, be my experience with it. And I found that sort of pushing it away, pushing it out of my consciousness, let me, in effect, buy some time and make longer-term adjustments.
Yeah, and Susie, I think something similar happened with you.
Yeah, definitely. I think denial is a part of coping and assimilation of information. And like Richard said, you can buy time. I remember when I couldn't deny the fact that there was a mass in my head when I was presented with the CAT scans that showed the mass. But even at that point, I thought, well, it's just it's a fluid-filled cyst or something that they won't have to remove. I know the neurosurgeon said to me at the time that the mass was acting benignly, which would have suggested, I think, to most people, the term benign sort of you associate with cancer. Well, that I never let cancer or brain cancer enter my thinking. And so about 2 days before I went in the hospital and I met with a pre-admissions nurse and we were talked all about the surgery, and when we're done, she said, and then, 3 weeks later, you and I will talk about your treatment plan. And I was like, treatment plan? I just have to have surgery. What are we talking about, a treatment plan? And I mean, that's how effective my denial was. And luckily for me, the mass was benign, and I didn't have to go through with that. But it also played an important part in my recovery, where my speech was really impaired. I had to just, as someone who was used to using my words and having pretty high standards for myself, I had to just sort of deny what I would have perceived as big failures or even small failures and kind of keep going to recover. So It was effective then as well.
Yeah. Let's try and get this caller again on the air in San Francisco. I'm told that the caller is there. I just hope we're not having a phone problem. So let's try again. Line four, listener in San Francisco, are you there?
Yes, I am indeed. I'm not a ghost, after all.
Okay.
there's a very interesting book that came out a few years ago called Our Stolen Future. And I believe they actually have a website that does continuing studies about whether it's epidemics or problems with hazardous wastes and whatnot. And I think it's ourstolenfuture.org. And I'm concerned about, with global climate change, one of the first things that's said in the models of global climate change is that there's going to be a rapid blindness, Of course, skin cancers is on the increase. But there's going to be a point where they say that 25 to 30% of the population of the world will go blind within a very quick period of time. So it's 25 to 30% of the population going blind, that crosses all bounds, economic, education. So you're going to have the scientists going blind as quick as the homeless people. And with that in mind, I'm wondering if there's some sort of a preventative basis. I mean, that your guests could offer something toward, say, for example, if we had a whole bunch of nuclear scientists going blind, and if they were to instantly go into some sort of a metal shock, then they're used to being able to control nuclear power plants would be essentially ruined. So if they were to keep their composure, if the population who are getting cancers from the various types of cheap junk that are being sold on the open market, you know, the carpet gases and the plastics in your car and, the various types of pollutants that are getting spread around are going to cause, thousands, tens of thousands of cancer cases. Keeping our composure so that we can dismantle this monster that we've created of hazardous waste is kind of what I'm looking at. And I'm wondering if there's something your guests might offer on this.
All right. Anybody want to step up and...
Well, I mean, I am legally blind, though it stems from a very identifiable neurological process. I don't think there's any conceivable way that it links to the concern that you have. I mean, I as one who shares everybody's concerns about the environment, I'm not sure how clearly I relate to doomsday scenarios such as that, and find it a little bit difficult to predict anything that dire actually occurring. But I will say that and I think Susie would agree with this, that that everything that we have experienced seems very dire to us. I mean, when it's your own life, it is, or at least seems as cataclysmic as what you're speculating about. And that's where I think coping mechanisms really come in. And I think we talked a little bit about denial, which I think we agree can be a good thing. I do think it's much misunderstood by people generally. And I just think that it takes a calmness and resolve to keep your cool and keep going forward.
Yeah, and I think it's impossible, to evaluate or predict which coping mechanisms you'll find within yourself until you're really confronted with the scenario. So while it seems extremely dire from a distance, it's amazing how quickly you begin to sort of break it down. But I'm an optimist, and I'm really sure that as soon as the president gets this same-sex marriage thing squared away, he's going to address global warming, and we're not going to have to worry about it.
Susie Becker and Richard Cohen are our guests this afternoon here on The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Gwynn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Richard is the author of Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness. Susie is the author of I Had Brain Surgery, What's Your Excuse? Two memoirs this afternoon about coping with serious illness. Have your senses of vulnerability changed over time as a result of living with serious illness?
Mine, definitely has. I had never even spent a night in the hospital before I got this diagnosis and was, faced with about the scariest thing I could imagine. And I remember sort of one of the big milestones in my recovery, and I related when I read in Richard's book about how he talked about overcompensating you know, by being strong in areas where you still had strength to, you know, compensate for other areas where you felt weak. I organize a 5-day, 500-mile bike-a-thon, and, you know, within months of this surgery, which most neurosurgeons wouldn't recommend undertaking such a thing, but I did this 5-day, 500-mile bike-a-thon, and it really contributed to my having a sense of autonomy and strength and beginning to get myself back. So I remember saying to my dad, you know, this, you know, this kind of thing teaches that you're both stronger and more vulnerable than you ever knew. And you say you get both sides of it. And my dad had a massive heart attack when he was in his early 40s. And remember, he said to me, but it's kind of amazing how quickly you'll forget the strength part of it when you're faced with, you know, the next situation. But it comes back.
Richard?
Yeah, well, I have a progressive illness, which means that it doesn't stand still. So it's a moving target. And I guess I would have to say that I spent a lot of years before the worst of it kicked in, denying it, as we've discussed, and not feeling particularly vulnerable, traveling the world, covering wars, presidential campaigns, and so on. I think when it reached a stage where it began to define me more than I had allowed that to happen in the past, then I really did have a very clear sense of my vulnerability, and it was really not that many years later that I was hit with colon cancer, and that recurred. So, you know, I was very much left with, you get a very, your own sense of mortality is very finely tuned. You know, I mean, you begin to realize just how frail we all are, and I in particular just didn't have the physical strength that matched my determination, and you know, it really made the whole thing just much more difficult.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Champaign, on line one. Hi.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I was. This might be more pertinent for Richard, since his disease is more progressive and chronic. I was wondering what his attitudes, what are your attitudes, Richard, about life support and ventilators and such? What sort of decisions have you had to go through about those things?
Well, I'm one of many people who really doesn't want heroic measures if I've reached a stage where I can't decide for myself. But I don't think that those questions, as important as they are, apply to me so much, simply because chronic illness tends to be much more life-altering than life-threatening, and the deterioration compromises the quality of life quite a bit, but it doesn't necessarily threaten your life at any given moment. I'm very sympathetic to those who believe in living wills and other legal means of bringing some rational processes to the end of life, but I'm not sure they apply to me more than anybody else in the population.
Thank you.
There is also a great document called Five Wishes that has you think through in a pretty detailed way end-of-life questions, everything from what you might want your funeral to be like to, you know, people keeping your lips moist or rubbing your forehead if that's something that would make you comfortable. I think it's accepted as a living will and healthcare proxy in like 38 states or something.
Yeah. Well, I think if you have a healthcare proxy and really trust the person who holds it, be it a spouse, a child, or a friend, then I think you're in pretty good shape.
Yeah. One of the things here that we're kind of touching on, I think, is that there are common threads in illness from one person to another. There's similarities, yet each individual is so different and each situation is so different. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to have both of you on the program together, you know? And I'm really glad that we've been able to do this afternoon. I want to talk more about coping. Richard, early in Blindsided, you write about how you received your diagnosis. The neurologist told you on the phone. His manner was very cool, and you say the "I'm sorry" was quite perfunctory. Then you write, "In those days it was diagnose and adios. Plan A did not exist. At that moment, my journey to a strange new land began. That place would be both exotic and rude. There would be no certain return. Illness is an unexplored frontier," Virginia Woolf wrote in a 1925 essay. "Sickness would take its place with love and war and jealousy as the forces of a newly defined life. They would be joined by coping, a word I did not really know." How has your relationship with that word changed over time?
Well, I think it has. I think it has evolved the way, really the way my illness has evolved. Coping is not a single thing, nor is coping the same for all of us. I think coping is really what gets you through the night, and I think each of us can have his or her own definition of it, and it really is defined by what works for you. And for me, at that moment of diagnosis, came a lot of decisions, and I realized in retrospect that I think that people make life decisions in an instant when they get bad news. I think that people can set the tone for how they're going to live their lives in an instant. And I decided at that moment to slow down, that I wasn't going to freak out, that I wasn't going to flail about, because I simply didn't know enough about the illness. I didn't know what I would be reacting to if I did have a large reaction. And the more I could talk myself down from the ledge at that moment, the more I realized that there was no reason to be up on the ledge in the first place. Not that it isn't scary, but it doesn't really buy you anything.
Yeah. And Susie, I think that one of your doctors advised you to rest, but you said, "No, I'm going on the Ride Far event."
Yeah. Throughout, it was just really important for me to assert myself as much as I could as a healthy person, instead of being gripped by the diagnosis, by the sickness, and, you know, by the impairment. I just wanted to kind of, you know, rise up against it.
What would the two of you say to someone who has been recently diagnosed with a serious illness about coming to terms with it?
Well, I get asked with frequency to talk to people, young people in particular, who are newly diagnosed with MS, and I generally tell them to slow down, you know, to pay attention. I wrote in the book about that exotic place just north of your neck, and I think you've got to start paying attention to what's going on in your head. That there's plenty of time. If you're not acutely ill, as opposed to having a much longer-term chronic illness, there's plenty of time. You know, for me, I signed up for a lifetime of an illness. There, you know, I didn't need to decide everything instantly. What was important then, and I think is important now, is to slow down, learn what you need to learn about an illness, but also take stock of yourself, reach down inside of yourself and find that strength and just understand the importance of resolve as you go forward.
Yeah. Endurance is an important part of this.
Well, I think emotional endurance.
Yeah.
I think, you know, being true to yourself, it would be hard for anybody, any one of us, to tell someone else how they're going to get through it. I think it is identifying in yourself what does make you feel strong. I think it's people who you want to surround yourself with. And I think a lot of people's natural impulse when they get a diagnosis, especially with the internet today, is to, you know, sit down at a computer possibly and type that in and be just overwhelmed with information. And I really tried to manage all the information, both what I was learning about it as I needed to know it, whether it was mm-hmm. what kind of a test I was about to have or, you know, the type of surgery I was going to have. And also sort of managing the communication of that information. It's not, you know, it's not necessary to tell, although there's a point when it's the only thing that you're thinking about. When someone says, how are you? You want to blurt out, you know, well, I've got a mass in my head. But, you know, you don't have to share the information with every last person. You can share it selectively. It was helpful to me to actually sort of designate friends in my life who I didn't tell for a while, just so I could be myself and not be looked at like a person whose head might be bulging because I had a mass in it.
Yeah. And Richard...
Yeah, I think Susie touches on something critical there, which is how, and because it's something that people like us have to think about, and that's how other people are going to see us.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's a very legitimate, powerful concern. And what you know, what you share, and what others are allowed to know really brings a lot to bear on how you will be seen, which in turn really affects how you see yourself.
Yeah. Well, sometime after your diagnosis, you got in touch with the recruiting officer at CBS, and CBS eventually called you back. They liked you, but there would be a physical. Tell us how you handled that situation.
Well, I had studied at Columbia with Fred Friendly, who was a former president of CBS News, and Edward R. Murrow's partner, and Fred, who I was close to, told me to tell the truth about the MS and that it was the honorable thing to do and that people would find out anyway. And when I got my master's degree and went to NBC, which had courted me for the year, I did tell them the truth, and I really could see the light go out in their eyes. I mean, it was really a warm reception and a cold departure as I left the building. And I realized right there that that honesty was probably a luxury I could not afford at that part of my life, and that the H in honesty was silent, and I was going to be silent too. And when I was offered a job some years later on the CBS Evening News with Walter Cronkite, which in my line of work was the top, I was going to get that job, and I wasn't going to let a company physical stop me. And I essentially cheated on it. I tested one eye twice and got in an argument with a nurse and told her she was wrong, and she bought the argument. And I never told anybody anything and waited probably close to a year before I told my boss. And when I told him, feeling secure, he said, I'm glad you didn't tell me because I probably wouldn't have hired you.
Mm. And Susie, there was a book deal that came through for you not long after the surgery, but you wondered if you'd be able to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I was faced early on with I a lot of what I do are cartoons, and you know, with the humor is a really subjective business, and so I have a cartoon in my book, the memoir, that you know depicts the editor's sort of subjective pile system. And you know, I think they kind of have a yes-no pile, but I thought there could be a weird pile, and then a pile to the other end of that, of the brain damage sort of not acceptable. And I just didn't want someone to look at my work after I got done, where it is off beat humor, and wonder if this one was like way off the beat. With the book contract, it was an I can read book, and I was wasn't really able to read myself at that point, so the idea of writing one wasn't all that promising. But my agent was really wonderful and just told me, you know, there's plenty of time, just wait it out. You know, these contracts take months to go through. So I, again, just decided to wait and see where I was when it came time to have to answer.
Yeah, and then also, you know, you and your agent talked about, well, what should we say, or should we say anything about your condition? And you just decided to go on and give it time.
Right, right. Yeah. She was totally supporting me. She didn't feel that the editor needed to know either.
Yeah.
In the best of all worlds, I think we all want to be as honest and forthcoming as we can. But I think we all learn, or many of us learn, pretty harsh lessons early on.
Yeah. Has the way you deal with disappointment changed?
I have definitely, I think, become less easily disappointed or redefined what's disappointing. I mean, I think before I had my surgery, I spent a lot of time striving, you know, I think, for perfection. And when I was really reduced to not being able to read, write, et cetera, once I got what I felt was essentially myself back, I was thrilled with that, and looked back at time that I spent, you know, trying to be perfect as kind of a waste, and I'm just, you know, really happy to be myself and view a lot less as disappointment.
You know, those who live lives of limitations, I think, begin to appreciate what they have in life, you know, and not simply measure it by what they can no longer do and by that disappointment. And I think if any individual can look at his life or her life and see the good things, see the accomplishments, see the family and so on, that that you just change your perspective and perhaps your priorities in deciding what is successful and not successful, good and bad.
Yeah. Susie, in her book, there are a lot of drawings in the book, and one of them is a graph of sorts called the disappointment timeline. And I think that's a great exercise, you know, to take a look at, you know, at what you think have been disappointments, and then go, well, really, it wasn't really all that, you know, a big a deal.
Yeah, although that was at an odd point in that whole trip, where I was, you know, within the week after I got out of the surgery, I was in front of a neuropsychiatrist, and I was just really scared and. You know, was I going to be able to do my work again? Was I going to be myself again? And he looked at it sort of as, well, what was wrong with me? Wasn't I able to manage a little bit of disappointment? You know, his question was literally, you know, have you ever had to deal with disappointment before? And I thought, well, gosh, you know what 36-year-old hasn't? And that's where I sort of recount these disappointments, from having my heart broken to, you know, not being popular in high school or whatever. But I wasn't really looking for something to manage my disappointment. I wanted to have some milestones that would give me a gauge of my recovery and some notion of a future.
Yeah, and also, though, I think there is, and maybe I'm misreading this, and forgive me, but I think that when you take stock like this, you realize that as you mature, disappointment looks different.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
because I think one of the items on the disappointment timeline is that you were given a doll and some clothes for the doll, but the clothes didn't fit the doll.
I'm gonna cry again. No, I know, it is funny to look back at those things that were huge disappointments.
Yeah, is laughter good medicine?
The best. I just didn't recognize, to me, that humor was really a way of a power I had over circumstances. So when I didn't have it, I just would look at them and not to be able to make fun of them. I was kind of scared by them or saw the seriousness of them. Now, you know, like, that my job is really to walk around the world and see the funny side of things is such a gift. And, you know, to be faced with a nurse who is standing over me telling me that this dye that I might be allergic to, you know, that might put me into anaphylactic shock reaction, was really expensive, and my insurance might not cover it. And when I asked her how expensive, and she said $85, I mean, that was absurd to me, although I did crumble and say, okay, go ahead, you know, just try it anyway. But I think when the alternative is fear, anxiety, and all those things, humor is a good way to go.
I think that's true. I think it's very liberating. I tell the story in my book of trying to pass from the kitchen into a dining room and seeing a gentleman approach the opening as I did and moving to one side, and he moves to that side, I move to the other, he follows. And I thought, this being New York, that he was being provocative. And as I looked up to say something to him, I realized I was standing in front of a mirror, and the other people around me were staring at me like I was crazy. And I just started laughing, you know, because there was little left for me to do, I suppose. But it was funny, and I think that there's, you know, for those who have ever read The Theater of the Absurd, there's something very absurd about illness. It's arbitrary, and if you allow yourself to see it, it does have humor embedded in it. And I think the more you can laugh, the less you cry.
Hmm. Did relationships with family and friends change?
I don't think they have to change, but they can be severely challenged. I know that one of the toughest parts of the book, of my book for me, was writing about the darkness and the isolation that I felt after the second colon cancer surgery, and how much of that darkness was imposed on my kids and on my wife, and the level of stress in the house was very high. Nobody knew quite what was going on, and everybody, I think everybody was tested, and what I realized is that we're not alone in those hospital beds, you know, our spouses, our friends, or our family are with us, even if we can't see them. And illness really is a family affair.
And I know my younger sister had a hard time after the surgery. I mean, she's about the person I'm closest to in the world. And I think it was our relationship, for one thing, was really verbal. So without my words, it was hard for us. And also, I think she was just really afraid. I was her big sister. But I have to say that, you know, with time, I mean, in fact, not a long amount of time, we closed that distance. And then she just had a baby last summer, and I was in the delivery room. And I would say, you know, now I look at it, and their relationship is essentially the same. But you know, it's tough it does test all kinds of relationships, and it's hard to predict. You know, you might think the person that you're closest to will be there for you, and in the end it might be the hardest for them to be that close, although they are, you know, kind of with you on the journey.
Yeah. In the very dark moments, how do you deal with that, and how do you deal with anger, and how do you avoid self-pity?
I think you can't avoid it. Hopefully you don't wallow in it. And, you know, I created this character in my book. I have these alter egos, and I'm not generally an angry, and I was termed labile or teary by the neuropsychologist who evaluated me, and those weren't ways I wanted to see myself. And I actually, for me as a cartoonist, I kind of parsed them off into separate characters, and I had this mad hat, kind of this smart-mouthed bowler who would be the angry me, and I think, I mean, you can't deny those parts of yourself, but the thing is just to not live in them all the time.
Well, Richard?
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think self-pity is a waste of time, really. It just doesn't take you anywhere. You know, I never wanted to see myself as a victim in any way, and I really don't see myself as a victim in any way. I think the question of anger for me is a much more difficult question. And it's not anger at anybody in particular. It's not pointed. But you know, if you're waving a loaded gun around, it really doesn't matter who you were intending not to hurt. And I think that carrying that kind of anger around hurts everybody in your zone of whatever. And I just think that that for me, anger management is probably the toughest part of it all.
Yeah. You know, I'm thinking here of the character in Fiddler on the Roof, Tevye, when he argues with God, and I wonder if that's something that you've experienced, whether it's God or the universe, that sense of this isn't fair, you know?
Right, but well, whoever tells you life is fair is perhaps selling you a bill of goods. I mean, it's all arbitrary. I think we all know that. You know, I mean, somebody gets hit by the car and somebody doesn't get hit by the car. And, you know, and I never want to be likened to Joe because he's a kvetch, and who wants to do that?
Mm. And I think the second you ask yourself, you know, why me, then you have to think, well, why not, you know, everybody else?
Mm.
So it's... Yeah.
Good point. Richard, you call your book a reluctant memoir. How did you decide to sit down and write this memoir?
Well, I wanted to write a book about coping because I was increasingly interested in that subject. And it's funny because we've talked about denial today. I was most interested in the concept of denial because I've heard it used by so many people as a negative, and here I was thinking of it as a positive. But the more I wrote, the more I frustrated my editor, who didn't like the way I was structuring it, the more I realized, or was made to realize, that my life was the spine of the book, that I had lived everything I wanted to write about, and it was reluctant because I thought of myself as a private person. I had started, I've written a number of columns in the New York Times about tracking my experience with colon cancer and MS, but I really didn't want to reveal myself to the point that that I ended up doing, and to that extent it was reluctant, and now I find myself walking around naked, and it's cold out.
Susie, what led you to write I Had Brain Surgery?
Well, I right before I got the diagnosis, I had received a writing fellowship from Harvard, which I then, I started again months after my surgery, which they told me I could have postponed my start. But every time I was faced with a decision like that, to do that would have been admitting to myself or conceding that I was less. And so I would go and I went through the motions the first couple of months. I literally was on my floor of my office putting together a scrapbook. But when it got close, in January, I knew that I had to give a presentation to the Harvard community about this book project that I had proposed. And the book project I proposed was a completely different project, but I was going to have to present something. So this was, you know, in part deadline pressure. And then when sitting down to write some sort of a book, it was kind of a writer's advice, you know, that you write what you know. And this was the only thing I knew anything about. So I started on that.
Mm-hmm. That's where we have to leave it. I'm sorry to say we're out of time. Richard Cohen, Susie Becker, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Susie Becker is an author and artist whose previous books include All I Need to Know, I Learned from My Cat, and My Dog's the World's Best Dog. She's the recipient of the Anti-Defamation League's World of Difference Award, and she is the founder and organizer of the country's first AIDS bikeathon, Ride Far. Richard Cohen is a former senior producer for CBS News and CNN, a three-time Emmy Award winner and the recipient of many honors in journalism. He's a contributor to the health and fitness section of the New York Times. He is the author of Blindsided, Lifting a Life Above Illness. Susie Becker is the author of I Had Brain Surgery. What's Your Excuse? 9 minutes before 2 o'clock Central Time. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. I'm Celeste Quinn. Todd Gleason is standing by now. He has prices from the Chicago Board of Trade. Settlement prices, Todd.
Thanks very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade this afternoon, another interesting day, a great week at the Chicago Board of Trade. If you're looking for futures to go to the upside, I'll give you some numbers here on Friday to Friday settlements. Check this out. The soybeans up 64 and a quarter cents than the November beans this week. The March contract was up 49 and a half. The nearby corn contract, the March up 11 and a half for the week. The December up 8 and three quarters. Now, those are weekly settlements Friday, Friday. Here's the way the settlement prices came in for the dailies today. In the wheat pit, the March contract to the Board of Trade, 385 and a half, the high, the low at 379. A settlement price there at 380 and three quarters, down 6 and three quarters. May wheat, 394 and a half, high, low at 388. A settlement price at 390 and three quarters, 5 and a half lower. July contract, 395, the high, the low at 389. A settlement price at 392 and a quarter, down 3 and three quarters. September futures, 397 and a half, high, low at 393. Settlement at 394 and three quarters, down 3 and three quarters. In December, wheat, 403 and a half, the high, the low at $3.99. Settlement price at 402 and three quarters, down 3 and a quarter. From the corn pit, the March contract settled 297 and a half on the high, or 297 and three quarters on the high, the low at 294, and a settlement price at 296 and a quarter, up a quarter of a cent. May futures were a penny higher, a 304 and three quarters high, low at $3.75. Settlement price at 303. They finished once again one higher for the day. July futures 307 and a half high, low at 303 and a half. A settlement at 305 and three quarters up to September. $3.50 the high, the low at 296 and a half. Settlement price at 299 up 2 and a quarter. December corn futures, this year new crop, 297 and a quarter the high, the low at 292 and three quarters. The settlement price there, 295 and a half. They finished a penny higher for the day. And the March corn futures, 297 and a half on the high, the low at 294 and a quarter. March 05 corn settled 296 and three quarters, up one for the day. July, $3 the high, the low at 295 and a half. Didn't quite make a settlement at $3. 298 the settlement there in that July 05 contract, up 2 cents. And December for 2 years out in the corn, 268 the high, the low at 265. December 05 corn, 267, a settlement price a penny and a quarter higher. March oats at 156 high today, a low at 151 and a half, and a settlement price at the Board of Trade for the March oats at 156, up 4 and a quarter. May futures 162 and a half the high, the low at 157 and three quarters. Their settlement price, 162 and a quarter, up 4 and three quarters. From the soy complex, this is where a lot of the action happened again today. The March beans managed a settlement price 14 and a half cents higher. Their new high, 946, low at 918, a settlement price, 942 and a half in the March beans. They finished 14 and a half higher. The May contract, 941, the high, the low at 914, a settlement price at 937, up 12 and a half. And July futures, 924 the high, the low at 898 and a half, a settlement price at 920. They were up 11 and a half cents for the day. September on out, not nearly as high for the day. They finished anywhere between 3 and 4 cents higher. Primarily the September contract, 814 the high, the low at 796 and a half, a settlement price there at $8.08. They were up 4 and a half cents. The Novembers were just a penny and a quarter higher, and that's your new crop soybeans. 740 the high, the low at 723, a settlement price at 736. Once again, that November contract up 1 and a quarter. We'll talk to Mike Zuzulo this afternoon just about the differences between the old and the new crop in this case, and why the November couldn't manage to anything more than a penny and a quarter raise today. January beans, 739 the high, the low at 727, a settlement price at 735 and a half. That's up 2 cents. In the March futures, 735 and a half, the high, the low at 729. A settlement price there at 733. They're up 3. Of course, we'll talk to Mike during the closing market report at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock Central Time. March futures, 288. 80. The high, the low at 274. Settlement price at 279.90. Up 340. The May meal, 282.50. The high, the low at 275.50. And a settlement price at 281.40. Up 320. March bean oil at 34.40 on the high side. The low at 33.56. A settlement there at 34.19. They were up 14. And the May futures in the oil pit, 34.18. The high, the low at 33.33. May bean oil settled 34.03. They finished 37 higher on the day. Celeste Quinn's here with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. A lower day today on the Mercantile Exchange are the lean hogs. All those contracts, April, May, June, and July, finished higher today. March feeder cattle, 87.05, the high, 86.15, the low, 86.50, the settlement, that down 22.5. April, 86.20, the high, 85.30, the low, 85.50, the settlement, that down 5. May, 87.10, the high, 86.20, the low, 86.57.5, the settlement, net down 15. August, 88.50, the high, 87.85, the low, 88.15, the settlement, that down 32.5. February live cattle, 82.50, the high, 81.50, the low, 81.50, the settlement, that down 15. March, 79.35, the high, 78.95, the low, 79 even, the settlement, that down 7.5. April, 77.45, the high, 76.65, the low, 76.85, the settlement, that down 20. June live cattle, 73.15, the high, 72.62.5, the low, 72.92.5, the settlement, that up 5. April lean hog, 62.27.5, the high, 61.70, the low, 62.02.5, the settlement, that up 37.5. May, 61.60, the high, 61 even, the low, 61.60, the settlement, that up 25. June, 66.65, the high, 66 even, the low, 66.60, the settlement, that up 65. July lean hog, 62.75, the high, 62.15, the low, 62.72.5, the settlement, that up 35. February pork bellies, 97.50 the high, 94.90 the low, 94.90 the settlement, that down 130. March, 96.40 the high, 94.65 the low. The final price today, 95.95, that down 25. The Dow currently up 48 points at 10,628. The NASDAQ is up 1 point at 2034. The S&P 500 is 4 higher at 1149.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
James Marcus from San Antonio, Texas writes, Dear Dr. Science, I have a friend in Australia who asked if the phases of the moon are apparently the same to an observer in that country as opposed to the USA. I said, yes. Was I correct?
Yes, you were correct that the moon is apparently the same size in Australia as it is here, though the similarity is just in appearance. Actually, the Australians can't see the moon at all due to the fact that they occupy the bottom half of the globe, and the moon only spins around the top or normal half of our planet. But in order to make Australians feel